Thanks for inviting me here today. I was asked to give a general overview of X-ray observations of the gravitational wave counterpart. Yes. So there were a lot. So let me start with a brief overview. Basically, every X-ray telescope that could look at the source observed it. The earliest observations were from this wide monitor like MAXI and Super Agile that basically serendipitously looked at the source. The main problem is that we don't have a very sensitive wide field of view X-ray facility. So these upper limits from the X-ray at early times are early, but they're quite shallow. So the more interesting observation started at a later time with a pointed observation from SWIFT, NuSTAR, Integral GEM-X, and definitely Chandra. So if you want to know more details about all the X-ray observations, they were reported in the multi-messenger paper by the LIGO collaboration and the EM partners. I will focus mainly on the SWIFT and Chandra observations. So SWIFT, I think, was actually probably the one of the instruments that started observations at the earliest times. So our observation started less than 1 hour after the LIGO trigger. Do I have a pointer here? And we started this, you know, to image the all LIGO location and GRB location. So we started with this. Okay, here. We started here, starting from the region with the highest probability from the gamma ray localization. And then a few hours later, we received this updated LIGO Virgo localization, which was much more precise. And so we started to image this field here, and we just targeted the galaxies within that region. So unfortunately, we did not weight the galaxies by mass or light, as other groups did. We just basically adopted a strategy that was the best for our scheduling purposes. So this means that we did not image NGC 4993 until 13 hours after the trigger, after the SWOP team released their GCN. So the upper limits that we got from the other regions, so from all the other regions, that we imaged, we did not detect any X-ray source, and the upper limit that we got is about 10 to the minus 12 erg per centimeter squared per second. So the most interesting results, of course, are coming from the pointed observation of NGC 4993. So I think the SWIFT observation really gave us the first evidence that what we were looking in the UV and optical was not a standard GRB afterglow. What you see here, this is the UVOT image of the field. You see there is the bright galaxy, and this bright dot is the UV counterpart. So we detected this bright 18 magnitude source rapidly fading with the UVOT, and very surprisingly, we did not see any X-ray emission at the same time. And this is really unexpected, because I think most people at that time, this happened 13 hours after the trigger, I think many people at that time thought we were seeing the afterglow. And this was really the first evidence that this was not a standard GRB afterglow, because the SCD was very unusual. So what you see in this plot is, the upper limits from SWIFT and NuSTAR compared with the average behavior of GRB, short GRB afterglows in the X-rays. So these upper limits also told us that if there was an X-ray afterglow, it was unusually fainter than the average that we observed with SWIFT. So this was either suggesting a low luminosity event, intrinsically low luminosity, or an off-axis explosion. So I think the real breakthrough happened a week later when we started to observe with Chandra. So Chandra actually started observations 2 days after the LIGO trigger, and there were 4 observations performed until the target went into sunblock. So the first observation at 2 days returned a very deep upper limit. And then this was followed by 2 observations by our group, one at 9 days and the second one a week later, 15 days. So what we found in the first observation at 9 days was a clear source here at the same position of the optical and infrared transient. So what you see here is actually our discovery image. There were 12 counts, and so for people not familiar with Chandra, 12 counts is a very high significant detection. Based on this detection, we requested a follow-up observation to track the temporal evolution of this source. So this observation was awarded and performed at 15 days. What we found is that, I mean, the source was still significantly detected, and it was slightly higher flux, suggesting a slowly rising X-ray emission. The last observation was performed 16 days by Haggard et al. And kind of confirmed these results. So one thing that it's important to understand is that Chandra was really the only instrument that was available capable of delivering this result for 2 reasons. First, because of its sensitivity, the flux of the order of 10 to the minus 15 were really not within the capabilities of SWIFT or other X-ray instruments. But most importantly also because of the angular resolution. As you see in this image, there is a bright galaxy center here, and also the region is full of other X-ray sources. You see these red dots, probably X-ray binaries. So it's very important to have angular resolution in this type of cases so we could disentangle the gravitational wave counterpart from other sources. So based on these 4 observations at early times, we could constrain the properties of the X-ray emission. So what you see here are the temporal properties. Okay, this is not a very constraining, but we could say from the initial data that the emission was rising very slowly with a slope of about 0.6. The luminosity was about 10 to the 39 hertz per second, so much, much fainter than typical GRB afterglows at the same time. And as you see here, after 2 weeks, the target went into sunblock. This means that neither Chandra nor SWIFT could observe it anymore. Now, you see, this sunblock lasted for 3 months, and we are getting out of it this week. So we are actually expecting observations from Chandra this week. There was a SWIFT observation performed a few days ago, and it did not detect anything. But as you can see, the upper limit up there is not very constraining. So it's basically telling us that the source didn't do anything too weird, but it's not constraining when compared to the model and the expectations that we had. So these are the temporal properties. Looking at the spectral properties, based on the X-ray data alone, we cannot really constrain much the spectrum. We cannot distinguish between a thermal or non-thermal emission. But in this case, the radio data are useful. So with this plot, we can see that the X-ray and radio data are actually consistent with non-thermal power law spectrum with a photon index of about 1.6. These 2 measurements were taken at 15 days, so more or less at the same time. And if we compare this with the standard synchrotron emission, this means that both X-ray and radio data should belong to the same synchrotron segment. So basically, they're probing more or less the same type of emission at that point. So once we detected the X-ray emission, we started to, I think it was clear from the beginning that the X-ray emission was not behaving as a standard GRB afterglow. So we examined the possible origins of this X-ray emission. So here are the models that we discussed in our paper. I'm sure there are other models, but these are some of the most common. The magnetar scenario is something very popular in this period, where the magnetar power a long-lived X-ray emission. We found that this model is not consistent with the timescales involved, because it would imply this very long X-ray emission for a couple of weeks would imply values for the magnetar that are not realistic. Other models are the fallback accretion proposed by Rossi and Begelman, which, however, predict a thermal spectrum, so it cannot really explain the presence of the radio emission. Another model is the interaction of the ejecta with the interstellar medium. And also in this case, this is possible, but the onset at 9 days will require densities that are way too high. So we don't see any evidence for a dense medium, neither in the X-ray spectra nor in the optical spectra. So we don't think this is a plausible model. So at the very end, we found that there are two main models that are still consistent with the data. One is this idea of the off-axis afterglow. So in this model, basically the X-ray emission and the radio emission are coming from a jet seen at an angle, a highly relativistic jet seen at an angle, and the other set of models instead explain the whole emission with this cocoon idea, or in general this low Lorentz factor fireball. So it's, the difference is that this is not collimated, it's nearly isotropic. And again, the Lorentz factor is not highly relativistic, but it's over the order of a few. So I think there are many people here that will talk about the cocoon or already talked about it. I'm not going to focus on it, but I'm going to talk a little bit about the off-axis interpretation, which is the one we favored in our work. So in the off-axis idea, what we suggested is that this GRB 1708-17A is a very standard, ordinary gamma ray burst, both in its prompt and afterglow properties. And the reason we observe it in such a different way is just because of the angle. So what we did here, we basically explored the properties of the standard properties of X-ray afterglows. So what you see here is a X-ray afterglow as seen on axis. And we asked whether by changing the viewing angle, we could reproduce all the data. So simply by changing the angle from 0 to 28 degrees, we found that we can reproduce very well the X-ray data as well as the early radio data. So the first scenario that we considered is the canonical top hat jet. So this is the the very common, but maybe too naive model of jet, where you have this uniform core. And we found that with this model, we can explain the early afterglow data pretty well from X-ray to radio. But we found we had some problems explaining the prompt emission. So when using these models and considering the large off-axis angle implied by the afterglow data, what you get are very unusual properties of the GRB emission, either a very low bulk Lorentz factor or a very hard spectrum, several MeV in peak energy, and a very high energy explosion. So we found that if we want to use this top hat jet, probably we need to explain the afterglow and the gamma ray data in a different way. So we found that possibly, the afterglow data are coming from the jet seen at an angle, while the prompt gamma ray data are coming from a different component, a cocoon or any other kind of wide low Lorentz factor component. Another model that we consider is a jet with a structure in it. So not this simple top hat, but we consider a jet where both the Lorentz factor and the energy change as a factor of the viewing angle. So you see this is a scheme, and you see you have a luminous core here. We consider two possible functions. One is a power law, so the energy decreases as a power law, or a Gaussian function. And when compared to the data, the afterglow data here, we found that the power law jet is actually not consistent with the data because the emission coming from these lateral wings is too bright. So we will see too much emission. This is not consistent with all the upper limits we have at early times. However, we find that the Gaussian jet can actually represent the afterglow data pretty well. And when using this model, we can also explain consistently the prompt gamma ray data without invoking any other component. So this represented a consistent explanation of both the radio, X-ray, and gamma ray data. So here is a little update since then. The model, so you see the model we presented here as a very rapid decay here at around 1 month. This was due to data per limit that turned out to be not so reliable. So considering more data from the radio mainly, this is an updated set of models. And as you can see, even considering the updated radio and X-ray data, the structured jet can actually reproduce all the data. So what you see here are a set of light curves that are consistent with the data set acquired so far. Here is more or less now, so the time when we expect our Chandra observation. And you see that in the X-ray, the spread of parameters is more than an order of magnitude. So having an observation here could really help narrowing down the range of possible solutions that are still allowed. So within this JET model that explains both the gamma ray and the afterglow data as coming from a highly relativistic collimated JET, we think that this gravitational wave counterpart is going to change as a function of the viewing angle. So future LIGO detection may not look all like GW1708-17, but the way they're going to look is going to be a function of the viewing angle, with on-axis counterparts being dominated by the afterglow. Intermediate angle counterparts are going to look like this, so we can detect both the blue kilonova, the red kilonova, and at late times, the afterglow. And for edge-on observer, basically, we expect to see just the red kilonova, depending, you know, this is a schematic model, but the idea is that if this picture of the angle of the off-axis jet is correct, then future observation should show a variety of behaviors depending on the viewing angle. So I'm gonna leave you with the future prospect. So if we expect the target to be still visible by Chandra for months and maybe years, if the X-ray emission is gonna raise, probably SWIFT is going to be able to detect it as well. We think additional X-ray observations will be very important to constrain the synchrotron spectrum. Maybe at this late time, X-ray and radio are not going to probe the same region of the synchrotron spectrum, so that would be very useful to probe at least two different regions and segments. And I think later times, the distinction between the structured jet and the cocoon should be more evident, so maybe we will be able to tell the difference. I think the top hat jet is already disfavored by most of the data. For the future, if the jet scenario is correct, then we might be able to detect the decay of the afterglow. This will allow us to constrain better the orientation and the opening angle of the jet, and that could complement also the gravitational wave result. And finally, we don't know whether there could be additional components in the X-rays, for example, coming from the interaction of the subrelativistic ejecta with the medium. So we cannot exclude there will be more surprises from this object. Thank you.
Okay, so Udi and Ito, you're not going to argue about the structured jet versus the computer, like, really?
We need more coffee.
I apologize to the audience because it's probably boring at this stage. But can you first define what is the difference? First, how do you decide what is the structure of the jet in your structured jet? Second, what is the difference between structured jet and a cocoon? And third, how can you tell the difference in the future between a structured jet and a cocoon?
Well, the difference, I don't... Well, in both cases, we have some low Lorentz factor material coming at a wide angle. So physically, I don't think the effect of a structured jet or a cocoon are going to be different, but they're intrinsically different because one is coming from a collimated, I mean, one implies the presence of a collimated, highly relativistic jet, the cocoon does not.
No, it's not true. The cocoon can have if a jet
cannot have as well. We don't know whether there is a jet or not if it's a cocoon.
No, there must be a jet. The jet is producing the cocoon. Without a jet, there is no cocoon.
But the jet might not break
might
out.
Not break
from
out.
It.
Yes. So the difference between a structure jet and a cocoon is whether the jet broken up. So the difference. I just try to understand. You said there are two models, and we can be able to distinguish between them. And I want
I think
to understand
the distinction
what are these
is,
two models.
Is that
and how can we distinguish?
I don't think, honestly, with one case we will be really able to distinguish, especially if you include energy injections and other free parameters. They might be very similar, but maybe in the future, you know, if we have a jetted emission, we should see a variety of angles. So we should see emission peaking at earlier times when we see the jet.
But also in the cocoon, you have a jet bringing up. The difference I see is that the cocoon is something physical that I understand and I can constrain from first principle of physics, and the structure jet is something that I can put by hand and do whatever I want.
So
can someone tell me how a structure jet looks like?
I actually think that, as we've heard before, I think it is a bit of a semantic issue. Does anyone in the room think there's no jet, like zero jet? Raise your hand if you think there's zero jet, any one of you. Okay, so let's get over that. Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Yes, indeed. But I think we have to just be careful when, you know, I don't think that anyone is saying, I don't think Mansi was saying, I don't think anyone was saying that there's no jet. The jet can be choked, it can be strangled, lots of bad stuff can happen to the jet. But everyone thinks there was a jet, so. Yeah, I think there is a bit of a semantic, there's something of a semantic issue, but I think there's also the actual physical structure of this thing, whatever
it
was. I think Eleonora had a description of it. Eleonora, would you like to just go back to your description?
Yeah, I think this is more, you know, the issue for a theory person than me. I'm an observer, but in general, I think the main point is, do we really believe that the top hat, this uniform jet, is the real physical description, or maybe there is really a structure in the jet? So
who thinks top hat? Anyone in the room? Anyone?
It's a tiny
Nobody. Yeah, so anyway, we're not talking top hats. Eleanor's not talking
top hats. Yeah, but I think what we use now in, for example, all the GRB studies, we still use the top hat model to, you know, describe the afterglow emission. It worked so far. We didn't worry too much.
If I may, you can distinguish, you can define a structure jet in a way that the origin of the material, okay? In a structure jet, all the origin of the material in all angle is coming directly from the engine. When you talk about a jet versus a cocoon, then the origin of the matter in the cocoon is coming from the medium, while the origin of the matter in the jet, which
the
is
origin of the
in
energy,
between the cocoon, is
the
coming
energy
from the engine. And that's
yeah,
it.
Exactly. Right,
but it is mixed. The shock jet material is mixed with the star.
I think Andrew should say
something. More questions for Eleonora.
Can I change the subject from structured jets? And so one of the things that's come up a few times is you know, this is unusual from the GRB perspective, that it's weak. And the question is, you know, we have a bunch of short GRBs that people have written off as being cosmological because there's no host galaxy association, but are these in fact nearby things where we just didn't get an afterglow? Is there any plan with SWIFT, I mean, to go back and scan short GRBs for longer and maybe look for, I mean, with this one you said you have to have Chandra, right? But could XRT get something maybe 5 or 6 days later, if there's any plan?
No, okay, well, it depends.
In the future, not for this one.
Well, actually, I think that SWIFT, it's more promising in the UV rather than the X-ray. What we learn is that our follow-up with SWIFT was heavily based on X-ray detection, and no one ever looked at the UVT very carefully. So we actually did that. We went back. We didn't find that many cases where there is a nearby galaxy within the BAT localization. In those cases where we found a nearby galaxy, there is no evidence for a UV source or an XRT source. So if it's true, there might have been a few cases in the SWIFT database, but they were not disclosed. They were probably, 100, 150 megaparsecs, so much farther, and there is no way for the XRT really to tell us anything, because our follow-up is includes very rapid observation within the, say, an hour from the explosion. So if this model, this late onset of the X-ray emission, is the standard pattern of these explosions, simply the observing strategy was not optimal. In the future, I think we're going to change that. I think now that we know how things look like, it's going to be different.
Going back to the jets, to make it maybe less semantic, I mean, there is an issue with what was the geometry of this material around the merger at the time when we saw this gamma ray emission. And is, you know, is it at 10 to the 10 centimeters? Is it at 10 to the 11 centimeters? Are we seeing, and so this is actually something that's actually probing the physics of the merger and telling us more about the story of how material was being distributed. So I think there is some important issues to resolve in terms of understanding the jets, so that maybe it helps us diagnose this material.
So this is just to help me understand now. So related to, again, structured jets versus cocoons. So leaving aside what we think that is, a short GRB on axis, yeah, is that a structured jet? Or how would people, would this, so at least my question now is, regardless of this semantics, if you looked at this event on axis, would it have looked like a short GRB? I feel like some of the talks today have said no, some have said yes. So there is some fundamental difference between some of these things. I'm very confused, and that's totally cool too.
Okay, maybe I'm gonna reply first because I'm the speaker, then we can just go turn around. So my view, I mean, the idea that we had is that yes, in our mind, you know, this should be a very common explosion. So if seen on axis, when we did the fit of the structure, we wanted it to have standard properties. So this would have a standard energetics, probably a standard peak energy. This is more or less everything that we can constrain with the models that we have so far. But our idea is, yes, if we see it on axis, this should have been a regular short gamma ray burst. And it just looked very faint, under luminous, because of the viewing angle. That is our idea. I don't know other ideas.
I think that we just don't know. It's possible. It's possible. I think that the data do not conclusive in any way.
So let me take a crack at that from the other direction, which is not so much whether this event, when we looked at it from another angle, would look like a short GRB or not, but I think that if you look at short GRBs that we do see at cosmological distances, whether the jets have structure or not is hard to tell, in the sense that, you know, we're dominated by the emission that's coming on axis. And usually for short GRBs, we kind of lose the ability to track the afterglow after a few days. And so if there is more energy at lower Lorentz factor, generally we're just not going to be sensitive to it. So I think it would be interesting to try to make a simulation of something like this and then turn it around and by 30 degrees or whatever it is and ask what it would have looked like on axis. But my suspicion is that it would be very difficult to tell.
Very fast, Ron?
Can you explain why you reject the ISM ejecta interaction for the X-ray?
Well, for the X-rays, because we, there are some models that predict when this emission is expected to, peak, and usually to have the onset at such early times, like 9 days, we found that we would need a very high density of the circumburst medium.
My naive expectation would be that at the age of 10 days, the total mass in the ISM that the ejecta got is roughly 10 to the minus 7 of the total ejecta. And therefore, all you need is just a tiny part of the ejecta will move at, let's say, 0.6 C or something like that, which is in order to explain.
Well, I think it depends on the model that we use, which is this interaction of a subrelativistic fireball with interstellar medium, we actually need densities of the interstellar medium of the order of 10 to the 3 centimeter per cubic centimeter in order to have the luminosity and the time scale that we observe.
But you can do it with 0.04, you know, to explain the X-ray. That's
Not in the model that we use the Nagar-Pirard.
You can do it on the board.
Model. Maybe other models can explain it, but I don't know them.
Okay, so I think that we have to thank Eleanor again for generating this exciting discussion. And we are going to continue with Raffaella Margutti, who's going to talk about the radio and X-rays. The show is still on.
No, no, it's